This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Lawrence Kutlikoff back to the show. He is a professor at Boston University, a very renowned economist who has probably done more study and research on our unfunded mandate problem that we will talk about today. Can't wait to dive into that again. And he's also a software entrepreneur, and he's got some great software tools to help planning for all of this stuff. Larry, welcome back. How are you?
Great to be with you. Very good, thanks. And I hope you're doing well, too.
It's good to have you back. So last time you were on the show, I think we talked about the unfunded liabilities that the United States is facing in terms of all these entitlements that it has promised to people for the next forever, I guess. But maybe the 15-year mark is sort of the primary one to look at. I don't know, you can say. But that total, a lot of people call it the $60 trillion time bomb. You say it's about, I think last time you said it was about $220 trillion, but even that isn't enough, is it? It's even worse than that, right?
Yeah, the most recent number is that our fiscal gap is $239 trillion large. So what is the fiscal gap? So this is putting all the obligations of the government onto the books, and also all the assets, including all the future tax receipts, onto the books and taking the difference. So you're looking at all the outlays the government is projecting. Those are all the obligations, including paying for the government's lunch, defense expenditures, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all these expenditures into the future as projected by this Congressional Budget Office. And then you're looking at all the tax receipts that are projected into the future. And also you have the official debt that has to be paid. So you form what we economists call the present value, the value in the present of all those outlays. You subtract the present value of all the receipts, all the taxes to cover the outlays. You add in the official debt. You end up with $239 trillion. The official debt's about $22 trillion right now. So we're talking about a fiscal gap, a true indebtedness of the country when you put everything on the books that's 10 times bigger than the number we're talking about officially. So the Congress has been really good at hiding the bacon, hiding the big problems off the books for decades now. And our kids and are going to pay the price, but we're also going to pay the price as well because our kids are not going to be able to afford to pay us off.
Right. Wow, that is absolutely astounding. Now, the question is, though, over what time period does the government have? And by the way, I'm guessing you're just talking about the federal government only because, of course, states and municipalities have big problems, yes, too, especially if you look at Illinois and California, right? Well, absolutely. I don't know. California is kind of a mixed bag. I haven't paid that much attention to it lately, but as messed up as that state is, it sort of seems like they're doing okay in some ways too. I don't know. It's another discussion, but that's just the federal government. But over what time frame will we have this $239 trillion with a T dollar shortfall?
Well, that shortfall is calculated as of today. So the government, the country is short basically 10 years of GDP right now. One way we can deal with this problem is to raise all federal taxes by about 50%.
That's not going to work.
We just had a big tax cut, right, a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But we actually we had a modest tax cut. We need a major tax increase, 50% mm-hmm. increase. If we don't do that now, let's say we wait 10 years, well, then we're going to have an even bigger increase. Maybe it's not 50%, 55%. So it's not like there's anything gained by waiting. There's only a bigger burden left to our kids because there's fewer of us around that are now around to pay the higher taxes. If we wait for 10 years, then people that are now, let's say, 80, some of them are going to die, and they will have gotten out from under this problem scot-free, if you like, because they'll die before the taxes are increased. So this is very much a generational equity, a generational fairness question. How much are we going to burden our kids? So we already have a situation where right today, we need a 50% increase that our kids will get hit with for their entire lives, okay? But we too, people my generation, people your generation, will have to pay higher taxes the rest of our lives, but our kids and all future generations will be stuck with this much higher tax burden. That's best case scenario, Jason. That's
best case. Okay, that's pretty scary. This is not positive at all. But it does seem realistic. But wouldn't those tax increases suppress economic activity, cause capital flight? Certainly, we've already seen this with the offshoring, and you know, maybe some of the tax plan will bring that back. We're certainly seeing people vote with their feet now because of the salt-related taxes, the state and local taxes, you know, that are now no longer deductible over $10,000 a year under the new tax plan. People are leaving those high-tax jurisdictions for more favorable places like where I live, Florida.
Well, we're getting to a point where you're absolutely right that if we raise taxes too much, we may have all the things you just mentioned, people leaving the country to live in places where there's lower tax burdens, capital not coming in. You know, for example, if we raise the corporate income tax back up, we may see corporations moving back outside of the U.S. You know, rather than having capital flow in, we'll have capital flow out. So there are limits to what the economy can absorb in terms of higher taxation. So we're getting very close to game over, to a point where the bills are so big that we can't handle it by raising taxes. And the other idea is to, you know, cut spending. So you'd have to cut pretty much every expenditure the federal government makes by about a third. So you'd have to reduce the gas on Air Force, the jet fuel on Air Force One would have to be cut by 33%. And the Social Security benefits would have to be cut by about that, and Medicare benefits. So we're in extremely scary territory right now with our fiscal budget. Not right now. I mean, this has been going on for decades. I've been writing about this for my entire professional career, which is a long time.
Just help us unpack, though, a little bit, Larry, the time frame. Like when I asked you that question, you said, well, we're $239 trillion underwater right now today. But we don't have to pay that today. We get to pay that over time. So we do get some benefit of what I call inflation-induced debt destruction, meaning that some of that will be inflated away, right? But we keep adding to it faster than it'll probably inflate away.
This analysis takes into account the fact that you're going to get some what economists call seniorage, which is that because of inflation, you're going to reduce the debt, you know, what you have to pay back in today's dollars. And also, so the analysis takes that into account already. It's really a matter of you've got a cancer growing in your body, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor is a politician, and he says, says, well, you know what? Let's just take a little bit out of it now, and you'll come back in 10 years. And you come back in 10 years, and it's much bigger than it was. And he said, okay, let's take a little bit more now. Takes even a bigger bite from you.
Right. Yeah.
Come back 10 years later. And you're on death's door because it's going after an organ.
Right.
So that's the kind of situation we're in.
Okay, that is...
We have no time left.
That is a mess. We are in a mess. But I'm guessing by your prior statement that you would not be a believer in maybe Arthur Laffer's philosophies or Ronald Reagan's. You know, I mean, they're obviously connected. You would not be a supply-sider or trickle-down type of guy, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. I went to work for Reagan in the Council of Economic Advisors, but not... I was a senior economist, so I wasn't very high up. I just wanted to have the experience of working at the council.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
And I thought, you know, I've done a lot of work on supply-side economics. I developed with Alan Auerbach, who's a professor at Stanford, sorry, at Berkeley. We developed something called the Auerbach-Kotlikoff model. It simulates the macro economy through time and responses of the economy to and the fiscal system to things like tax cuts. So it's kind of the penultimate supply-side model. So this is kind of why I was got hired down at the Council of Economic Advisors. And basically what Art Laffer and other people were claiming, the model doesn't produce or reproduce. There are certain things, you know, if you have sky-high corporate taxes, for example, lowering them and having capital flowing from the rest of the world, that can help your economy. But just cutting personal taxes actually will not pay for itself. And so we knew that back in 1979, well, 81 when I started working at the council. So a lot of what Laffer said is just not true.
Okay.
It wasn't true then, not true today. And then we have some other people on the left, like we have the modern monetary theorists today who are
MMT,
thinking you can do the same thing, and it's just a different angle of craziness.
Yeah, I think MMT is just crazy. It's fantasy land.
We have a bunch of people that want to pretend that you can consume for free.
Yeah. I wish it were as easy as MMT. That sounds so easy. You know, just keep running deficits and spending money and you'll be fine. But, you know, I'm just curious, and I won't belabor the point, but I just got to ask you, like, that sort of that common sense view of it, the layman's view. It seems like if you give people a tax cut and they have more money in their pocket, won't they spend it? And if they don't spend it, they're going to save it, which is good because that's capital formation for, you know, and that savings obviously works its way into the economy too. I mean, I don't know. That just seems sort of common sense, right?
If you give people a tax cut, then the government will have to borrow more money, and then the principal and interest will have to be paid by somebody in the future. So it has to be repaid. So you're giving, let's say we give put on a tax cut for the next 10 years. So we let older people like me pay lower taxes than we'd otherwise pay for the next 10 years. By the end of that 10-year period, some of us will have died. And anyway, we'll have gotten to consume more. But who's going to have to pay for that tax cut? Our kids and our grandkids.
Right. But the obvious thing is, don't you, when you consume more, don't you increase the GDP, right? And that's more taxable.
We got the Laffer Brothers, we got the modern monetary theorists, and then we have the old-time Keynesians mm-hmm. who believe the more the government spends, or the more the government gets us to spend, mm-hmm. the more the economy is going to flourish. Well, on that basis, we should cut taxes to zero, have a huge party. And what we'll do is save nothing as a country. We're saving next to nothing as it is mm-hmm. because we're so consumption-oriented. Our national saving rate right now is about 4% of national income. It used to be 15% in 1950.
Yeah.
So with very little to save, we can't really invest that much in our country. And that's why foreigners are investing in our country for us, in effect,
mm-hmm. yeah.
taking the investment opportunities. That's why we're running what's called a current account deficit. So, no, the idea that you can consume your way to prosperity is not something that's worked in any economy, you know, ever.
I agree. And again, not to belabor it, because I do want to, I want to talk about Maxify and stuff like that. But it's not a debate, at least in my eyes, between saving and spending. It's a debate between, I mean, look, remember when George W. Bush was president, right? And he sent out that, I mean, not him, but, you know, his administration was running things. He sent out that tax refund and everybody got like $630 or something, right? And I thought, okay, so everybody got a rebate of $600 or whatever it was. You know, they got more money to spend in the economy. So now they're going to go to the shoemaker and the baker and the butcher and they're going to spend that money and it's going to trickle through. And then those people will pay taxes and, you know, the pie gets bigger.
No? Here's the logic of that. I think there's some logic. If you're in the middle of a great recession like we were, mm-hmm. at least it was characterized as a great recession. I don't think in the end it would have to be that great. But if you have a situation where everybody gets scared, panicked. Mm-hmm. So I start laying off my employees who are your customers, and you start laying off your employees who are my customers, and everything starts to melt down.
Deflationary spiral, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just a economic implosion.
Okay.
We need something to turn around that psychology, because what happens here is the economy goes from a good equilibrium, a good position, to a bad one. And that's what happened, I think, in the Great Recession. We just got freaked out. Because none of the causes of the Great Recession that were alleged to be the causes were actually true. Now, I have a paper on my website, kotlikoff.net, called The Big Con, which talks about the alleged culprits of the Great Recession and what actually the facts are now that we've looked at them over time. So I think we had a panic. The government comes in and starts handing out checks. Now, that had gotten everybody from thinking we're going to have this terrible time to thinking times are good again. That could have gotten me to stop firing my people and you to stop firing your people and could have put on the brakes. But it may also have just freaked us out more. Look how bad things must be if the government's sending us $640 checks.
Right. Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that when we understand that the economies can move because of psychology, then we have to be very careful about how we play the psychology game mm-hmm. here and change the attitudes. And I think a better thing that Bush could have done then, well, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, was to go to the building. I would have gone to the building the same day it declared bankruptcy. I would have taken the people coming out of the building, and I would have grabbed one of them. And, well, each one of them, as it came out, I would prick them with a little needle, and they had blood. Mm-hmm. And nobody died. I would have, as the president, I would have done that. Mm-hmm. I want to take a pinprick of you. and show everybody in the country that you didn't die.
Right.
That you're actually going to be able to work. You're not going to work for these people, but you'll work for somebody else next week.
Right.
And then I would have taken a hammer or something hard, a sledgehammer, to the building and said, look, this building is still standing.
Yeah. Right?
That could have changed the psychology much better than handing out checks.
You know what? That is so fascinating that you say that, Larry, because I have long said that the Great Recession or any economic malady, really, you know, during any time we've gone through this, if most people consider the Great Recession to have started the day Lehman Brothers fell. I think it really started about a year before that when the mortgage collapses started, but whatever, right? If you went to bed and then you woke up and you saw that Lehman Brothers collapsed, that 156-year-old company or whatever it was, and then you remember you looked around before you went to bed, before you knew that Lehman Brothers was collapsing, every asset in the world was there. There was a certain amount of gold. There was a certain amount of oil. There was a certain amount of every resource on earth, copper, you know, whatever you want, right? And the next day after the collapse, the resources were the same. They didn't change. They didn't go away. The oil didn't evaporate. The gold didn't disappear.
Right.
The whole world had the same amount of assets. Now, they did admittedly change ownership, right? But they were all still there, right? The same amount of real estate existed. But because it's this, what Alvin Toffler called a super symbolic economy, and we have this financial engineering that Wall Street does, which is so scary, you know, the credit markets collapsed. And when you have credit-based assets, like real estate especially, and the mortgage pool dries up, well, then the price does decline, right?
Yeah. Nothing real changes. So you're going to have the financial system collapse, but it doesn't mean we don't have a financial system. We had the biggest bank in the world, the Federal Reserve, took over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another thing President Bush and President Obama should have said, look, you know, we don't actually need Wall Street. We have
the Fed
Reserve, and they're going to do all the job that Wall Street did. So let's stop getting upset and panicking and go back to work. That's what we do as Americans.
Yeah.
That never happened. So the only reason that we had this, you know, you referenced, Jason, the mortgages
meltdown.
It turns out that the subprime mortgages were too small relative to the entire mortgage market, and too few of them actually went into default for this to really explain to have produced a Great Recession. Mm-hmm. It's just too small a deal.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a movie like The Big Short come out where it's suggested in that movie that every other mortgage was liar loan, and no dog loan, an ninja loan, and everybody decides, oh, for sure, this is the cause. But that's why reading this article, The Big Con, maybe we should talk about it together at some point on our podcast here. It just turns out that when you look at every single explanation of the Great Recession, whether it's the mortgages, the subprimes, the banks being more leveraged, not true, households being more leveraged, they were, but they didn't actually spend the money. They just invested the money. So in some sense, they had assets to cover the borrowing. Rating companies did not systematically overrate. In some cases, I'm sure there were some overrating, but not systematically. So every explanation just doesn't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
We have time to look at the facts.
I can't wait to discuss The Big Con. I'd love to have you back to do that because that sounds fascinating.
Yep.
And I think our ideas about it agree a lot. So one last thing, and then let's talk about the solution as to how people plan for what's coming, okay? And you have some software to help them do that. But with $239 trillion looming out there that need to be paid somehow, it seems to me like the only solution is going to be inflation, right? The government is going to have to create money to pay the bills. I've outlined six possible ways that the government could get out of the mess. If it's $60 trillion, if it's $220 trillion, $239 trillion, whatever the number is, we know we have a problem. So the first one is default and just say, look, sorry, you know, austerity is the way it's going to be. That's not going to work. There'd be riots in the street, right? Look at Greece, look at other examples of that around the world. They could raise taxes. We talked about that. Now, my view is when you raise taxes, you suppress economic activity. You know, that's a political debate, maybe more than anything. Number three solution is they could have a yard sale. They could sell the ports to Dubai. They could sell military equipment to Libya. The BLM could sell off land. You know, there are some options there. We do have a lot of resources in the country. Heck, we could sell Alaska back to Russia, right? I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying it's available. We could use the American military machine to steal the assets of other countries. That's the history of the world, basically. Or on the good side, we could have some great technological innovation, okay? Some great America-centric discovery or resource, biotech, energy, I don't know, whatever, nanotechnology. Or the most likely solution, inflate our way out of the mess. It seems to me that you think inflation is coming. That's what I think.
So if we defaulted on the debt, we'd pick up about $22 trillion out of the $239 trillion.
Right.
So that's small change, actually.
Sure, sure. But it could be an ongoing default. You know, say we're just never going to pay anything. Sorry. You know, government workers, you're out of a job. Social Security, you're never going to get it. You know, whatever.
Okay, well, defaulting on all the expenditure obligations, yeah, that's like cutting spending.
Yeah.
But that will lead to, as you said, riots in the street, basically, you know, old people in particular.
It's not going to work.
They're canes and walkers and being up on Congressman.
It's politically unacceptable. It's never going to happen.
So inflation, the problem with inflation is you can't get much money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the most you could do, I mean, if you ran hyperinflation today and you still maintained Social Security benefits in real dollars, you index them for inflation as they are, you could at most deflate away the official debt, which is $22 trillion. So again, you're not going to get, well before you get to the point of eliminating in real terms what you owe on the debt, you will have hyperinflation. You'll have people treating money, dollars, as a hot potato, and then you'll have money circulating much more rapid clip, and faster money is like more money, so you'll have prices going up because the money is circulating more rapidly.
Yep.
So inflation, I think, is going to be the first resort of the government, but I don't think it's going to do much except produce a lot of inflation, just like it isn't doing much in Venezuela. The country is still broke. It's not like they're able to invest in any, you know, the government can raise resources by running a hyperinflation.
I agree. And it didn't work in Zimbabwe or Hungary or Weimar Republic or anywhere else. But we have one major advantage, the reserve currency, the biggest military. The U.S. is in admittedly a better position than any of those, right?
Just, you know, we have the advantage just until we lose it. Now, you know, the British pound was the reserve currency until
Soros,
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, World War II, that, you know, after World War II, we started, it became the dollar. I don't know whether you would date the dollar's preeminence before World War II or not, but anyway, certainly after World War II, it was the dollar.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing that says it can't turn into the yuan, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese currency, because, you know, people will move out of the dollar if the dollar is not trustworthy, and if its real value is depreciated because prices are going up. Yeah.
It could happen, I agree. I just don't see it happening soon. It can certainly happen. I mean, there, you know, but when you've got the biggest military and you're the biggest customer of the world.
Let me explain one thing, though, on this front. The U.S. has about 17% of world GDP right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we might be thinking that we had like 30% or 50%, but no, we're actually a small share. We're a significant but not dominant share of world GDP.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the century, just in about 80 years, we're projected to have about 5% of world GDP. So we're going to be to the world in 2100 what Germany is to the world today in terms of our economy size.
Yeah, fair enough.
So the idea that we can have this hegemony over the world for decades, forever, is not the case. So I think we need to start understanding our place in the world is not what it was in 1950, and that's not going to be even where it is today down the road.
Fair enough. I'm just saying that most people listening aren't planning for 2100 yet. They're probably not planning to be alive. So,
yeah, you know. We'll go out, you know, 20 years or 30 years, we're probably going to be going from about 17% of GDP to about 10%.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah, no question about it. Okay, but is the future inflationary, deflationary, stagnationary? And then what do we do about it?
I certainly would not buy long-term U.S. Treasury bonds that are not inflation indexed.
Right.
I wouldn't buy any long-term corporate bond. I wouldn't buy any bond denominated in dollars beyond a couple of years in terms of maturity. And I've, you know, steadfastly stayed away from such securities personally ever since I started seeing this problem.
Okay.
Because I think we will print money, and I don't think it'll do much for us but it will happen. Yeah.
Okay, so that's inflationary is sort of the net of that, it sounds like. So what do we do about it? I mean, planning becomes even more important. Last time you were on the show, we talked about your software that helps divorcing couples divide assets, which is really quite a bit more complicated than it seemed before I took a look at your software. And you've got some other software that helps people plan for the future in many ways with a great degree of detail. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I'll do that. Let me just say right before I get into that, there's a website called purpleplans.org, www.purpleplans.org, where I talk about what I would do if I were running the country to fix the $239 trillion fiscal gap.
Mm-hmm.
How to fix Social Security, how to fix health care, how to fix taxes, how to fix banking. Anyway.
Sure.
So,
good.
Purpleplans.org.
Why is it purple? Why the
purple's
name?
Like a mixture of red and blue.
Okay. Oh, okay. Got it. Got it. Okay. Got it.
Republican, Democrat. Right.
Okay. Good. Okay. So planning for the future, what do we do?
Well, we each need to have a long-term financial plan. I think anybody who's a grown-up would understand the importance of that. But I've been spending the last 34 years, actually now it's not, sorry, 35 years, 36 years now.
It's later than you think.
It's now 36 years ago I started this company. We have a tool called Maxify.com. It's Maxify.com. It's a financial planning software tool that helps you figure out, based on economics principles, how to have a secure living standard into the future, and also how to safely raise your living standard, and also how to invest your money to limit the riskiness of your living standard. So economics is all about your living standard, because we're into trying to have you have a smooth level of consumption, a smooth lifestyle through time, because we don't want to be partying today and start eating cat food when we're older, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not our objective in life, nor do we want to starve today and party when we're 90. We might not even make it to 90.
We want to balance it out, right?
We want to have a smooth path, right?
Okay.
So conventional financial planning tools don't give you a smooth path. The first thing they ask you is, how much you want to spend in retirement? Well, my answer is I'd like to spend $1 billion a day in retirement. It's a stupid question because, you know, you can only spend based on what your resources are. Our software realizes that. We ask about how much you've gotten, how much you're earning now and into the future when you're going to retire, how much assets you have, regular assets, retirement account assets, and, you know, other kinds of questions about your assets, your off-the-top expenses on housing and so forth. And then we figure out the smooth living standard path per household member. We say, okay, we've taken all that information and we've used really smart algorithms that I developed based on my economic research program to figure out in about a half a second how much you should spend such that you can keep on spending it every year for the rest of your life. Okay, now we have your living standard path, and then the program will robo-optimize that. It will look at Social Security benefit collection strategies and how to deal with your retirement accounts so that you don't pay more taxes than you need to get your living standard from here to here.
Mm-hmm.
The software is also dealing with your cash flow issues because your living standard may not be perfectly smooth. If you, for example, have a big inheritance coming in the future, your living standard will jump up at some point when you get that inheritance. So because you can't borrow against it.
Mm-hmm.
So, or you have big bills to pay like a mortgage and college tuition, you're gonna have to have a living standard down here and then it will jump up. So the software is really great in dealing with that issue that's very important for about
Larry.
Anyway,
I gotta interrupt you because I have a big idea here. You just made me think of something. Remember how they used to sell viaticals and now they still do like a life insurance thing? I invested in one of those and lost money on it. It was a scam. But here's another financial instrument. Wall Street, are you listening? Financial innovation, here you go. How about a loan against a future inheritance? The millennials would love this. They could eat avocado toast all day long, never be responsible, and then they could borrow against an inheritance. It's like a reverse mortgage, you know?
Oh, yeah, I think that would happen if the courts would enforce it.
Yeah.
It's a security, it's a good idea. And you just need to get the legal system around to letting this happen.
Yeah. Well, and here's the reason it can't happen, by the way, because number one, it would be an incentive to kill people, but so is life insurance, really. And number two, basically, if your parents had to contract away the inheritance and could not change their will or their living trust, you know, then you wouldn't treat them nicely until the end. So, you know, that wouldn't be a very good deal for them.
Yeah, there's a lot of difficulties with this market.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're back to smoothing your living standard, raising it. And by the way, you can tell the program that you think Social Security benefits are going to be cut or taxes raised. So that's part of the the software. So you
can you put in your projected inflation rate, I suppose?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
So the program is going to tell you, okay, here's how much to save this year and every year in the future. Here's how much to spend. Here's how much life insurance to buy. So your survivors have to the dollar the same living standard. And then it's going to raise your living standard. And then it's also going to say, okay, tell us about how you're investing your assets. So we set up a based plan for how you're going to invest. And then we compare that with a risky strategy and a safer strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is we run what are called Monte Carlo simulations, which are, we run, let's say you're running the program. The software is going to run 500 trajectories of your living standard based on the returns you would get on your assets that you're holding, let's say in your base case.
Mm-hmm.
Then we say, okay, let's feed all those trajectories of your living standard. First of all, we show you what they look like, how spread out they are. And then we say, let's plug those into a mathematical function that trades off your being happier if you get to consume more, but also you're being less happy if you're with a downside risk. So it kind of trades off risk and return. And economists call this expected utility. So what we do is we show you the expected utility from your base plan, from investing in a more risky way, investing in a safer way. And you get to, by playing around with this tool, you get to see what's the optimal portfolio for you to hold given your degree of risk aversion.
Interesting.
So this is what economics has been saying to do for decades, really. Modern portfolio theory in economics started in the 1950s. So we have like 60 years. And this is the first tool that actually is bringing economic portfolio recommendations or economics portfolio analysis and recommendations to the public in a simple tool at maxify.com.
That's really interesting. How long, you know, it just begs the question. It sounds complicated. How long does it take to input one's data and set it up so they can find out the answers?
Well, the program works like TurboTax, so it's a very easy interface. I'm going to give you a copy to still take a look. So it's just, you know, first question is, what's your name? You know, are you married? What's your spouse's name?
Yep.
Do you have kids? So it's question by question. So it's a wizard. It holds your hand. And then after you've entered the inputs, which might take you a half an hour, if you have your information about your assets, may take you a little bit longer. But how long does it take to go see a doctor to have an annual checkup, right?
Yeah, right.
It takes at least an hour. So you do this, and then you hit, you know, produce a report, base case report, and it shows you by holding your hand, here's your lifetime budget. Here's all your resources. Here's how much you're going to get to spend on a lifetime basis on discretionary spending. And by the way, the next slide is going to show you how to spend it evenly, smoothly, so you have a smooth living standard per household member. And so it's walking you through the results, holding your hand. So it may seem like it's complicated because it's designed by an economist, but we actually had real designers who interact with the public who are not
not just you ivory tower folks, right?
It's not. Yeah, it's a user interface developed by non-economists.
Yeah.
And so it's actually very user friendly. It was written up about last August in the New York Times. They did a writer wrote an article about what to do 5 years before retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big article. And it said the first thing to do 5 years from retirement is to buy Maxify Planner and run it.
Yeah, that's great.
You didn't mention any other program.
Yeah. You know what's kind of interesting about this in talking to you about it is that most of these programs and reports and projections and really the financial planning community in general are built around this concept of frugality, right? You know, save for retirement. What I think some listeners might discover, this won't be true for all, but, you know, maybe a little less than half or so of at least my listeners, I got a pretty sophisticated crowd. I think they'll discover that they might not be spending enough money and enjoying life enough. You know, that's an interesting take, right?
Because nobody has done lifetime budgeting for them.
Yeah.
Say, well, how much can they spend right up to the maximum age of life? We plan for people to live the default value is 100.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not focused on you're dying early, so you need to save more.
Right.
You know, the financial industry is engaged in so many different types of product sales and efforts when it comes to their software and the way they do their financial planning. It really bears no relationship to consumption smoothing, to this idea of having a smooth living standard and then safely raising it. It's actually giving you advice that's pretty much the exact opposite of what economics recommends.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because a lot of people, though, you know, to just look forward to maybe the great next technology that's coming for life extension, you know, we might have too much life left at the end of the money. That's most people will have that problem. And it's sort of a good problem to have in a way, I guess. But
it's not a financial problem. No, it's terrible.
Yeah. But some will. Well, I mean, I'm just saying it's good to live longer, right? You know, generally. But some will find out that they really need to enjoy today a little more, I think. That's the interesting thing about this.
Even if they plan to live to 100 or 110, you can do that in our program.
Yeah.
It could change the maximum age of life. But there's lots of people that are oversaving because they're overly scared about their finances. But but we have lots of other people that aren't undersaving because they think Social Security is going to be bigger than it is. They think their retirement account money is going to last longer, but they forget about the taxes that are due on it. The program is super careful about taxes and both federal and state.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare Part B premiums are really a big issue for older people.
Yeah.
And then also, of course, you've got all the Social Security benefits. There are 11 different benefits this the program calculates.
Yeah. Good stuff. You know, one of the things that people need to think about is, when should they start taking their Social Security? Should they take it as soon as they can, or should they wait a little longer and get a higher amount? You know, these are all big questions.
Yeah, and the program is optimizing over those choices.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say you're going to pass away at 80, the program is going to think differently about, if you say that's your maximum age of life, you're absolutely convinced you're going to die at that date, you know, before that date. The program is going to decide, you know, may have you take your benefits earlier rather than have you wait till 70 to get a much higher number. Well, there's probably about 3 million people that can get pre-spousal benefits if their other spouse takes their benefits somewhat early in order to get them going on getting a pre-spousal benefit, because they're still grandfathered under the old Social Security law that was pre-2015.
Yeah.
So the software will figure all this stuff out and tell you, here's what to do.
That's great. So it's maxify.com, right?
M-A-X-I-F-I.com, yeah.
All right, Larry, thanks again for joining us. It's always great to talk to you, and we appreciate that. Just a closing thought on the economy or where it's going or what people should do, anything.
Yeah, the economy is doing pretty well, but I'm not seeing a lot of real wage growth, which is what we're hoping for, because the economy's been, you know, workers have not seen major wage increases for decades.
Yeah, 41 years. Yeah.
So even though the unemployment rate is low, which is great, you know, our real incomes are not rising. So we have lots of productivity growth, but it's not going to the typical worker. It's going to the super rich.
Yeah. Well, it's the winner take all society problem. The C class executives are keeping all the money for themselves. And
there's another resource called at Kotlikoff.net called "You're Hired: A Trump Playbook for Fixing America's Economy." It's a book. It's a free book at Kotlikoff.net. Mm-hmm. Just download it. There's a tax reform there. I've got a different one at purpleplans.org, but the tax reform at this book, which is, again, called "You're Hired" rather than "You're Fired," right?
Right. Yeah, I get it. I get the reference.
Ask the rich to pay their fair share of taxes by taxing their consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So it talks about having a progressive consumption tax.
The national sales tax idea?
Yeah, but just for the rich. You know, if you're consuming more than like $250,000 a year, you have to pay taxes on your consumption.
Yeah.
I've
always debated that, and, you know, that's a topic for another show, but would you reduce consumption? Would you get people that are just hoarders and misers then? And I don't know. You know, this is complicated.
No, I don't think the super rich, the reason President Trump has not revealed his tax returns is that he hasn't paid any taxes.
Yeah.
This is not unusual for people who are super wealthy. I mean, suppose
I believe it. I mean, look, Trump's a real estate guy. You get depreciation. It's the best tax write-off in the world, right?
Suppose I'm not in real estate, but I have $1 billion. What I do, Jason, is I just go borrow. Let's say I have it in stock.
Yeah.
Okay, well, my $1 billion worth of stock, and the stocks are appreciating, and I don't want to sell any of them because I'll have to pay taxes on capital gains. So what I do is I borrow against the stock. I pledge the stocks. So I borrow to consume. I can borrow as much as I want against these stocks at a low rate. And then when I die, I leave the stocks to my kids who don't have to pay the capital gains taxes because the
basis steps up.
Step up in basis.
Yeah.
That's the way the rich do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they do other things. They have offshore accounts and they have captive insurance companies and they do all kinds of things that are so complex. It's you know, they pay lawyers and accountants hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, if not more, to set up these vehicles because it's worth it. There's an incentive, you know, it's incentivized.
So our economy will not suffer if the rich pay their fair share.
And yeah.
Certainly the country in general needs tax revenue like crazy. So,
well, this is all complicated stuff, and I'd love to debate this more. I do want to have you back to talk about the big con, okay? So let's do that for sure. All right?
Okay, absolutely, yeah.
All right, Lawrence Kotlikoff, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.